The purpose of today's lecture, which, as you can see, is given the broad title of Transatlantic Influences, is to continue that exploration of how Britain and histories of journalism were kind of being developed by what was happening on the other side of the Atlantic, the other side of the pond, and also in terms of what was making us British was changing, adjusting, beginning to evolve in all sorts of ways. Last week we looked at the work of the Angry Young Men, and we looked at the kind of ways in which Kingsley Amis and John Osborne were reacting against what they saw as overt American influences on their lives. They were arguing that American consumer culture was undermining traditional British values, and that British culture and British identity would disappear under the pressures of what they saw as American consumerism and American throwaway culture. But then there's a flaw in the argument, because in many ways, those angry young men were as much the products of an American influence as the young people in the coffee bars, such as the Two Eyes coffee bar in Soho, that they criticized. And why was this? Why did we actually get this development occurring? Well, partially due to the onset of the social sciences. The social sciences came to prominence in the United States during the 1930s. These are basically economics, psychology, sociology, and political science. We've talked about them in the past, and we'll probably continue to talk about them in the future. Through research and statistics, the social sciences were designed to provide valuable information for politicians who were primarily trying to counter the worst economic and social effects of the Great Depression, which undoubtedly has impacts on both sides of the Atlantic. The general feeling was that if one could find out how society worked, then you could actually change it. Just as you know how a machine works, you know how a combustion engine works, you can adjust the car until it actually works to your satisfaction. You can make minor adjustments, you can predict and control outcomes. In other words, you're viewing society as a machine that can be fixed when it goes wrong. And science and public policy planning would change everything for the better. Think back to the first lecture, we were talking about Milton Keynes and expanded town centres and variations within that. And from the 1930s as well, clearly, advertising companies were also very interested in finding out the results of surveys. This is the onset of the finding out of Gallup polls, of people finding out what people think, what people view. Private companies would employ psychologists to check the morale of their workers. There would be time and motion studies put into place. Character testing, the beginnings of what we now refer to as psychometrics, making sure that you fit the right kind of job or the right kind of employee is developed for the right kind of role. And all of those character tests were designed to get best results in order to organise workers, to control them, and also to improve the products that they produce, be they white goods, rather like fridges, washing machines and so on, or indeed other products of the Industrial Revolution. Now, all of those ideas of the social sciences crossed over from the Atlantic, certainly after the Second World War. They would have come across earlier, but obviously we were a little bit occupied between 1939 and 1945. But inevitably, by the 1950s, they resulted in a British demand for new university courses, with a greater number of middle-class students learning new skills and training for new jobs in planning, in adult education, in public policy, in social services and so on. Again, nothing that we haven't necessarily mentioned beforehand. And that in its own way created a new generation of young British graduates in the 50s and the 60s who would read Kingsley Amis, they would listen to jazz, they'd go to the cinema and they'd watch new wave films. So again, aspirational but also being impacted by what's happening in the United States. Up until this point, within the States, we'd really only had the Korean War. And again, I'll show you how the impact of that as this lecture hopefully proceeds. But one of the key elements that American influences was rejected by British intellectuals was this drive towards consumerism. By the beginning of the 20th century, American industry was in very, very good health. Factories would be pouring out goods, the stock market was soaring, credit was easy to come by. Companies would produce new goods through advertising campaigns, and those advertising campaigns would quite explicitly use techniques that were honed in war propaganda. The original propagandists, or the original public relations people, emerged from propagandists during the Great War and subsequently in the Second World War as well. If you've actually got used to spin through wartime morale-boosting systems, it's not too difficult to transfer that into a civilian environment as well. Labour-saving and luxury goods would be hitting the main streets. And things like telephones, vacuum cleaners, washing machines and cars, all products of the Industrial Revolution, a second Industrial Revolution, the Technical Revolution, would all be seen as not just aspirational and desirable, but essential goods for all households. American films themselves could be seen as mini advertising campaigns. They would carry images of the American way of life, at least for the idealized middle classes all over the world. And again, I don't have to necessarily make explicit the irony in terms of what we have here. Just look at the gender and the race in particular, the racial breakdown of those people who are in the advertisement with the strap line, "There's no way like the American way," and of course the people who are actually in the queue. Middle class Americans would come to consider their standard of living to be a right. The right to liberty, the right to happiness, would also be conflated with a right to consume. And the centre of the corporate world in America was effectively shifting, certainly in the 1950s, from Wall Street to Madison Avenue. If you're familiar with the series Mad Men, you might have had an insight into some of the things that were being developed within Madison Avenue. That's a location in New York whose aim basically was a democratic capitalism, fairer distribution, with everyone having a home, a fridge, a car. And if you had those things, then obviously you'd be happier. Again, this quantification of happiness, which we still talk about today in terms of happiness indices and so on. Building material companies, construction industries, appliance manufacturers, all would fuel the American dream in popular magazines such as Life, Better Homes and Gardens. So again, you're having a self-fulfilling, self-fueling dream that's being pursued and so on. And this ideal family in the ideal home with happy parents, happy children, was very much at the heart of American entertainment and the general accepted wisdom of where people were heading towards. The barbecue, the family vacation, the car, the appliances, the fashion, the safe neighborhood, all of this would be seen as, again, the American way. By the end of the World Wars, of course, there were changes politically. We've already seen how the British Empire was beginning to shift and work in terms of different ways, and how Britain was effectively having to deal with the downfall and the demise of the empire. The Middle East had put up oil prices. Remember the challenge over the Suez Canal and the difficulties there. And America was actually spending so much on defense because of its fear of Soviet retaliation and Soviet first strikes in the nuclear age, that actually America's debts were also rising substantially. It therefore became increasingly important, for financial reasons alone, to export that American way of life if the American economy itself was not going to collapse. So, it's not a case of simply spreading the American dream because of some religious zeal. It's a financial imperative to basically make sure that product is being sold overseas and so on. Almost making America great again, one could argue. By the 1950s, the influx of American ideas and American goods was beginning to change the look of Britain. Coffee bars, Coca-Cola, jukeboxes, American music, American films and fashions all flooded the market. Critics, again, as noted, argued that American culture was destroying British culture. People would be watching American films, they'd be listening to American music, they'd be losing touch with their own past and their own identity. In other words, these obsessions with American values were seen as destroying those of Britain, destroying the family, destroying the community, and arguably presenting an image where people would pursue happiness with a new fridge, a new fashion, and would look for deeper personal happiness. In other words, folk would be shallow. They'd be dissatisfied. If they didn't get the latest shiny toy, they'd be upset, you'd have a kind of childlike satisfaction. Particularly when you're focusing on this notion of the right to consume being the focus of what life is all about. When actually, maybe it isn't all about that. Maybe there are other things at work as well. Now, as we'd see, the American dream, fronted by Uncle Sam, was to export the joy of capitalism throughout the world and democratic consumerism. Arguably, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's providing individual liberty and so on. And there was a genuine belief within the United States of America that they were exporting the best type of society globally, that they gave others the right to participate in the American way of life, that Britain, under its democracy, was sort of okay, but ultimately it was a British Empire ruled over by a monarchy, which America had obviously kicked into touch a couple of hundred years previously. So there was this notion of how things were going. And if America was going to prosper, then clearly it needed to get both Europe and Asia on board so that they could develop global markets. However, the problem is not everyone accepts the American model. And the Soviet Union, which obviously had become established in the advent of the First World War, in the aftermath of the First World War, and Stalin was now happily ensconced with the leadership of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, was very much a competing socio-economic model. The model, of course, of Karl Marx, the model of communism. Now, communism, and again, this is truly a very surface reading. If you want to read Das Kapital by Marx, obviously feel free to do so. But communism primarily is a system which believes that production should be owned and controlled totally by the state. Society should be classless and shouldn't be based on consumption. It should just be based on needs. After the Second World War, the Soviet Union occupied most of Eastern Europe. You can see in this particular image here the notion of East Germany, Czech Republic, Slovakia, then known as Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, all countries which effectively had fallen, hence the symbolic notion of tombstones on the red iceberg there, to the problem of communism. In addition to that, clearly China had also decided to take a communist line of thought, as indeed had North Korea. So slowly but surely you're seeing this development in which the Soviet Union is occupying most of Eastern Europe, China has had its communist revolution, and communists, just like Americans, wanted a world that was modelled on their own system. As I said, possibly you actually have Mary on one side and yourself on the other. A whole range of sort of challenges on that system. The consequence of this, of course, is normally war. However, the challenge with war is if you both got both sides armed with nuclear weapons, you'll destroy the planet. It would therefore be a case of mutually assured destruction or madness to effectively go to war. So what you actually do is set up a series of proxy wars. It was never in the interests of either the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR, or Russia, or indeed the USA, to actually go to war once they actually had nuclear technology. So what they actually settled for was a series of ideological wars. Ideological wars which would be based on propaganda, on metaphorical saber-rattling, and so on. No, neither side could actually fight a war directly, but they could get involved in what are called proxy wars, actually getting somebody else to fight almost on their behalf. And the first of those proxy wars was actually located in Korea in the late 1940s, early 1950s. The Korean War took place between 1950 and 1953. There were 2 million civilian casualties, and 500,000 of those were amongst the Allies in the South. Those Allies included Britain, the United States, Canadian and Australian troops. North Korea had approximately 1.5 million casualties, including Chinese troops and Soviet advisers, but as many were still missing, it's still unclear in terms of how many were actually lost in North Korea. It is, however, clear that during the 1950s and 1960s, the Cold War became a way of life. There were clear ideological differences between the East and the West, between communism and capitalism. So you have a world which is effectively split in a binary opposition between two major competing ideologies. The main arenas for ideological and military intervention, in other words, for proxy wars between the superpowers, were the areas that we now refer to as the Third World. These are areas where European empires, like the French Empire, like the British Empire, had either crumbled or were in the process of crumbling. And there was a fear that the Soviets would actually take over, or indeed the Chinese. One of those colonies, as you can see on the slide up there, was the French colony of Indochina. If anybody's ever seen The King and I, you might have seen a snapshot historically, and done by Rodgers and Hammerstein, of course, of what the era or the area was and the kind of concern with respect to that under French rule primarily. Indochina incorporated what we now know as Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. During the Second World War, the Japanese occupied all of Indochina. Again, the Japanese part of the Axis of powers. You had the Japanese, the Germans, and of course the Italians. The systems change. By the time the Japanese actually left, they had basically put in place a revolutionary movement which sprung up in Vietnam, and the idea of that was that they'd had enough of being the colonized. They'd already had to cope with the French for a good 100 or so years, and after kicking out the Japanese, they were basically saying, never again. They were looking to actually seek a new life for the population. But France, perhaps unsurprisingly, wasn't happy with that, and so they actually tried to regain the colony. Now, having just had a Second World War in which they were occupied for the vast majority of it by the Nazi movement, clearly France wasn't really in a political position to actually do that, but they sought and succeeded in getting American backing. Why did they do that? What was the situation that allowed America to get involved in Vietnam as a result of the French backing? Well, it was that. There was a big fear that the United States, if they didn't actually support France in trying to actually take back the countries under Indochina, that actually the domino effect would fall into motion. Domino theory is a well-known stratagem which states that if one country falls to communism, then in this particular case, as you can see, China goes communist, then Korea will go communist, then Vietnam, Laos, and before you know where you have it, Malaysia, Indonesia, Burma, India, the whole thing will be communist. That takes out virtually a third of the planet in terms of if you want to export your idealism of capitalism to that particular area. So you've clearly got problems from that point of view. Indochina is also very rich in rice, in rubber, in coal, and in iron ore. Indochina itself is very much a gateway, as you can see if I just turn back to the map here, a gateway to other countries in Southeast Asia, other commodities markets. In other words, if you take out that whole area and put it, mark it into red communist areas, you've obviously got a situation which is going to create difficulties. So, allowing for the fact that American interests are at stake here and America has agreed to support France, what do they actually do? Well, first of all, throw money at the problem. They funneled in billions of dollars to bolster the French. And when the French actually tried to pull out and realized that they couldn't actually handle the situation, America, under the guise of the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, put in their own puppet government in Saigon under a gentleman called Diem. Now, Diem, there he is on the right-hand side. Oh, no, he's not there. Sorry, I'll show you Diem in a few seconds. That's Ho Chi Minh. Diem was a very unpopular leader to put in place. It was the equivalent of when Saddam Hussein was put in charge of Iran. Some people thought he was okay. The vast majority thought he was dreadful. He was also a Catholic in what was predominantly a Buddhist country. He also imprisoned any of his critics. He was pro the landlords as opposed to the peasants. And all in all, was not really a particularly key person to actually have as best friends forever. The communists in the north of Vietnam gathered around Hanoi as a centre of government, led by the gentleman who is there, Ho Chi Minh. And in 1960, rebels in the South under American control formed the National Liberation Front, which was called the Viet Cong. Now, at the same time as this is taking place in Vietnam and Indochina, America has had a presidential election. Eisenhower has been voted out, Nixon has not been voted in, but John F. Kennedy has. And John F. Kennedy was a supporter of Diem. He was also a supporter of American involvement in Vietnam. So now you have a situation where North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were taking on what was the greatest military superpower in the world. They're insane. But then the Vietnamese, as I said, have a long tradition of challenging occupation. You can go back before the Japanese, back before the French, even to the Chinese, to see this notion of the plucky underdog basically sticking it to the occupying power. And Diem, the leader of Vietnam, wasn't coping at all with any dissidents to his pro-American regime. To the extent that in June 1963, just months before Kennedy was assassinated, a Buddhist monk sat down in the public square in Saigon and set light to himself in protest. Big, major political problems. There were others who followed the monk's example. The response of Diem was to arrest more people, to lose temples, to fire on protesters. All of this, from the public relations point of view, is extremely bad publicity. Add to that the CIA are working subversively in a country to support a military coup by the generals, and there are also about 17,000 unofficial American advisors in Vietnam by now. 17,000 people all covertly there, all egging people on to effectively support the pro-American line and so on. The vast majority of those advisors knew about a coup that was being planned by the generals against Diem, and effectively he apparently provided lots of urgent phone calls asking for advice. Diem ended up dead in the back of a truck. 3 weeks later, President Kennedy was assassinated. What the flip do we do now? Lyndon B. Johnson, who took over LBJ from Kennedy, because he was the vice presidency at the time, was the person who obviously was entrusted with taking over the reins of power. And the gentleman sitting next to him, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, was actually a relatively new politician, but he was a social scientist. So again, very much a believer in using science to figure things out. LBJ, clearly at this particular stage, some might say out of his depth, but still very inexperienced. He also sensed that actually he wasn't in control of what was happening. Events were beginning to move out of all sorts of other areas. Kennedy, who supported the war in Vietnam, has been assassinated, and turmoil is happening throughout the states. In 1965, America finally started a full-scale war in Vietnam. In other words, they'd given up with the attempted change by subterfuge, and in this particular instance, not going nuclear, but using every other weapon at their disposal, including obviously drafting soldiers up, etc., they decided to invade Vietnam and win back North Vietnam, etc. Result? Total disaster. By 1968, 500,000 American troops were in Vietnam fighting a fairly dirty guerrilla war. Some of the facts that are worth considering. America, as a country, dropped more bombs than the entire German, British, and American forces did in World War II in Vietnam. They also spread chemicals to destroy forest cover. They effectively operated a scorched earth policy. And they used something which you can see in this particular, unfortunately famous picture, napalm. Napalm's gasoline jelly that actually sticks and burns people alive. The army also went after dissidents in various search and destroy missions, where it's clear civilians who may or may not have supported nationalism and guerrillas were often killed and taken away to refuge camps. In a project called Operation Phoenix, the CIA executed 20,000 civilians without trial because they were suspected of communism. This is not good PR for a country that tends to be sort of plumbing family values and promoting the best of all sorts of other areas. And because this is also being revealed to the world via mass media, you're getting an awful lot of reaction impacting in terms of what is happening here. There's a lot of debate about why Harold Wilson did not support British troops entering into the Vietnam conflict. And there's lots of debates in terms of, at the time, it was thought, well, Wilson must obviously be some sort of Soviet agent because he's not sort of supporting the Americans. However, 1968, the statistics continued. In My Lai, a detachment of Americans on search and destroy missions killed 450 to 500 women, children and elderly, lining up many of them in a ditch and just shooting them. This war, unlike any other war, was driving people crazy. And it carried on until 1973. So literally 65 to 1973. It was a disaster in a military sense, because actually they didn't win. And actually the post-traumatic stress disorder that the troops actually were faced when they came back, because they were not treated as heroes, because in many cases they were anything but. They had problems from that point of view, political problems, and obviously social problems. The average cost of the war is estimated to have been around $100 billion. It also undermined America's self-belief, this notion that rather like the cavalry riding in to save the day, all was well with the world, it created problems. And Vietnam is probably only just now, with its tourism industry, beginning to recover from the whole system. There were 58,000 Americans which were killed, and 3 to 4 million Vietnamese. Now, inevitably, this war had a huge impact on Americans at home. Americans your age, college Americans, people who would actually be faced with the draft, in other words. The body bags would come home. The television would actually sort of reveal the war unfolding on a night-by-night basis. This was not the American dream that even white Americans had been promised. This was something that was clearly at odds with that and led to a whole range of increasingly politically charged protests. Young men would increasingly refuse to register for the draft. They'd burn their draft cards in protest. In San Francisco, 300 folk returned their cards in anti-government protest, but by mid-1968, there were 3,000 prosecutions of people refusing to be drafted, and by 1969, there were 34,000 people who effectively refused to be drafted. To take a momentary break and just actually give you a little insight into one of the musical elements that was taking place at the time, have a listen to this particular image and look at the images of Barry Maguire and Eve of Destruction. What we'll see in this particular element here is not only some of the Vietnam War images, but also the civil rights movement that was also gathering pace at this particular time, and others. And if you get a chance to listen to the lyrics, either live now or on your own time when you download it from Blackboard, I think you'll find it quite interesting.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war. What's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save. Will the world in a grave? Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Yeah, I'm so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here
You may hate your neighbours, but don't forget to say grace. So, problems. And problems which are of an international nature, certainly reflecting on America, reflecting on how people operate within that process as well. And as you saw within that, there's also a gradual growing presence of protesters, both in America and indeed in other countries, very much from an anti-American protest, actually arguing against this war that nobody could quite understand why it was taking place and so on. It lacks the clarity of World War I, World War II, where at least you could possibly argue that there was a clear enemy in sight and so on. In 1967, there was a huge Pentagon demonstration by anti-war protesters. This was actually the brainchild of Abby Hoffman, who was also co-founder of the Youth International Party. Obviously, we see the growth of not just hippies, but also yippies in this particular area. And from the whole perspective of New Age thinking and so on, there was an attempt here to actually levitate the Pentagon via mental images alone. It was peaceful, but it was followed, regrettably, by terrible violence shortly afterwards. It wasn't just students, but also social activists who'd be protesting. And certainly by early 1968, those white, middle-class American family citizens were clearly feeling that actually the country was on the edge of destruction. That actually, whether it was a case of the space race, changing times, changing images and so on, there were clearly messages that were coming across here. Muhammad Ali, of course, the boxer, refused to actually serve, and the authorities took away his championship titles. War in itself and the Vietnam War was destroying people's belief in authority. And that generation gap that we'd spoken about really began to accelerate. There were millions of young people who rejected the values and behavior of their elders. These were comprised of students, but also young American workers as well. Clothing, language, sexual behavior, drugs, all of these things were rolled up in what Timothy Leary, a Harvard social scientist, said was time to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Because clearly the drug culture is also developing. So by 1968, the foundations of American society seemed to be under attack. Things were going from bad to worse in Vietnam, and Martin Luther King, who was campaigning against poverty, was assassinated, which also led to a huge outbreak of urban violence in the ghettos, which was also put down by soldiers. Shortly afterwards, John F. Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, who was seeking the presidential nomination on an anti-war platform, was also assassinated. Again, it would be some kind of tragic comedy if it wasn't for the fact that these things were happening one after the other. And in August 1968, thousands of anti-war demonstrators descended on Chicago for the Democrat convention. The city police assaulted marchers in what was later called a police riot, and hundreds were injured. Q, again, pop culture, anti-culture, and so on. The counterculture festival of Woodstock. A festival which also became a national emergency when the roads were blocked around the farmland in New York upper states. All of these events reached a climax in 1970 where Nixon, in an attempt to actually end the war, decided, well, we've invaded Vietnam, so what should we actually do now to sort things out? I know, we'll invade Cambodia. Genius. This actually led to even more protests, as you might imagine. And at Kent State University in Ohio, a peace protest against Cambodia resulted in the National Guardsmen firing into crowds of students. We had 9 injured students, 1 paralyzed, and 4 killed. The image that you see up there is of Marianne Vecchio. She was actually a 14-year-old runaway, and she is kneeling over the dead body of Jeffrey Miller. Again, not great publicity. This is not the enemy. These are your own troops doing this. Supposedly friendly troops, friendly police, and so on. Is it any wonder you have these challenges to the ideological areas and so on? Most publicity given to the student protests created the impression that actually it was mostly middle-class intellectual students who were protesting. But actually, blue-collar workers were opposed as well. And by 1970, most polls showed that 65% of Americans were actually against the war. Vietnam produced opposition by soldiers and vets on a scale which, frankly, had never been seen before. The thousands of desertions, the thousands of draft card dodgers, the thousands of people who moved north to Canada rather than be drafted, again, very much impacted on that whole basis. and soldiers in Vietnam itself started wearing armbands and badges that supported the peace movement. There was generally low morale amongst the troops over there, and there were 209 incidents of what is referred to as fragging in 1970. Fragging is basically when you roll a fragmentation bomb under the tent of a superior officer. The hippies, protest movement predominantly seen as an American phenomenon, also were developing as well. It's the sort of images of the Kent State, Ohio massacre, as it became known in 1970. But internationally, this gradually shift against the war was certainly opening up a whole range of developments, and attitudes, anti-American attitudes, anti-war attitudes, were beginning to percolate, just as the import of fashions in the 50s and 60s, music and popular culture and so on, had in fact inflected and influenced British culture. You were seeing a similar thing occurring here. By the late 1960s, Vietnam, like everything America touched, it would seem, had become an international issue. It bound together groups of protesters in many countries. It also helped to spread counter-cultural ideas about racial equality, about alleviating poverty, about peace, sexual freedom, drugs, music, and so on. It even resonated to the mid-1980s, 20 years after the American war, with Paul Hardcastle producing a number which actually sort of stayed a number one for a good number of weeks, actually. But again, because it uses some dialogue taken from actual serving soldiers as well, it's worthwhile just getting a little flavour, if you're not familiar with this particular number, to begin to conclude the session today. The tragedy is maybe nobody was actually sure what was going on, but one thing which was regrettably going on was mass slaughter and a whole range of problems. However, good news is Vietnam is more of a holiday destination now, so it's quite to ponder. Thursday we'll talk more about this and prepare the way, obviously, for what happens post-reading week. Thanks for your time. Make sure you stand the register. And